Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Grok Radio. The following broadcast is made possible by the friends and partners of CYI Worldwide Ministries and Grok Radio. And the views expressed in this program and by our guests may not necessarily reflect those of CYI Worldwide Ministries or its staff. And now, enjoy the show.
You stand on the shore of the ocean watching the tide come in. You sense the call of the sea beckoning to take you in further. You step forward little by little, not knowing what to expect, but expecting more. You keep going as the ocean calls you to enter in to deeper waters.
And welcome to the Deeper Waters Podcast. Once again, I am Nick Peters, your host, and I am seeking to bring you the very best in Christian apologetics and scholarship. Now, a little disappointment for some of you, Lynn Wilder was not able to be my guest today. We are going to be booking her for a later date, so don't worry about that part, but be in prayer for her. The reason she can't make it is her father passed away recently, and she's having to deal with that, and looking at Facebook with her and her children, I can tell that he meant a lot to all of them. So please be praying for the Wilder family and everyone else. Just hope that they'll make it through this time okay. And there's not much more I can say with that, but just be praying for them. For now, I did manage to get a guest who was willing to come on the show. Someone who's, let's just say, is willing to put up with me, I suppose. And that's Lenny Esposito. He's the president and founder of Come Reason Ministries, a Christian apologetics organization and author of a popular ComeReason.org website. He has taught apologetics and Christian worldview for nearly 20 years and has offered hundreds of articles dealing with intellectually strenuous topics such as the existence of God, theology, philosophy, social issues, and biblical difficulties. He's an in-demand speaker teaching at conferences, churches, and schools across the nation. He is a contributor of a popular apologetic study Bible for students and most recently contributed to the book True Reason, Confronting the Irrationality of a New Atheism. His articles have appeared in the Los Angeles Times and the Southern Californian Christian Times. He has debated many topics on faith and reason and the rationality of a Christian worldview, including Richard Carrier on the question, does God exist? He's a pioneer in online ministry efforts as he began using the website back in the 1995. And he produces one of the top 16 apologetics podcasts according to Apologetics 315. And let's hope this one makes it up there soon, too. And his site has been viewed millions of times by visitors from nearly every country in the world. Lenny, welcome to the Deeper Waters Podcast.
Well, thank you so much, Nick. I'm glad to be here and glad to help out.
Well, that's in a little bit about who you are academically, but some of my listeners still might not really know just who Lenny Esposito is. So what's your story?
Well, it's really interesting. It began back in, the mid-90s, where I wanted to take Bible study more seriously. I wasn't necessarily a full-blown apologist at that point. But I was interested in a couple of different things that were going on. First of all, I was interested in the idea of, taking the stories of the Bible, taking them out of their rather flat context that some people may get when they read the scriptures. You know, sometimes we read the scriptures where it would say something like, Peter saw the Lord walking on the water, and he said, Lord, if it's you, call to me, and I will come out and meet you. He says, come. And Peter sticks, steps out and starts walking on the water. We read that with almost like a fairy tale kind of approach. And I started wanting to go, what's the reality behind that? What, a 30-something-year-old man hanging his feet over the side of a boat, what does that really look like? What's going through his mind? So I wanted to do something that's interesting like that. At the same time, this 1994, so we were using things called bulletin boards. There weren't even a whole lot of chat rooms or things like that up as yet. And you had local ISDs. I don't even know that AOL was a gleam system at that point. But so I wanted to create a website that would marry those two things together and have also a little bit of the Bible Answer Man kind of concept where people could write in questions and we could talk about these more intriguing issues. So that's what I did. I went on a bulletin board. I found a gentleman who was, a couple of guys who were talking. One was an atheist, and he was putting forth all the arguments against Christianity for atheism. And I answered his points one by one, called an answering an atheist, and that led to him responding to me and started a discussion like that. And then other people would write in with other questions, and the site just grew from there. So this is back what I call it, the old gray page days, Netscape. Netscape 2.0 was out.
Wow.
So we started really, really early with online apologetics. That was kind of my primary entry into the field of apologetics, and it just grew from there.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what's been going on. It grew, I would say, along with my family. I'm now a father of four boys, and actually even have my oldest just got married and had a granddaughter. So I have a granddaughter now.
Wow.
So that's a short version of my story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like what you said about having kind of a fairy tale approach to the Bible, because oftentimes I thought we've become really much too familiar with a text. Sometimes we should be familiar with it in the sense that we should know it well and know what it means, but we shouldn't be so familiar with it that we kind of just glaze over the stories and don't realize how incredible they were at the time.
Yeah, I agree, and it helps in our apologetic too. I see not only Christians doing this, but atheists as well. For example, they start talking about the contradictions in the Bible, where Matthew talks about the Sermon on the Mount, Luke may talk about the Sermon on the Plain. They say, well, which one was it? Was it a Sermon on the Mount, or was it a Sermon on the Plain? And I usually respond with, have you ever met a preacher? If he has a good message, he will use it more than once.
Yep.
So it's that kind of a thing where they just take it this wooden literal fashion. Like,
mm-hmm.
You can't say the same thing to different crowds. It's not like they had tape recorded archives where they could go back and play their favorite messages. He had to talk about it in more than one spot in order to get more than one audience to understand his message.
Yeah.
So things like that.
Yeah, I refer to that more as the fundamentalist mindset, and unfortunately a mindset like that has led to, I think, too many apostasies in the church today, where it kind of becomes a belief of, where if there's one contradiction in the Bible, you can't trust any of it, and we have to throw the whole thing out.
Yeah, that's another issue that we have to overcome and understand, but regardless, I think taking the Bible, and I never say taking the Bible literally, I always say taking the Bible seriously.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a more clear understanding of how we approach the text.
Yeah. So. We're going to be talking about two topics mainly on the show today. First one, we're going to be talking about science and scientism. And the second one, we're going to be talking about ministry on college campuses. So let's start with science and scientism. I mean, first off, why this term scientism? What does it really mean?
Yeah, that's a fair question. I actually want to back up just a touch and talk about how science is perceived in the modern culture, because we've come a long way
mm-hmm.
with our scientific advance. It's really an amazing thing to think about how quickly we have scaled the peaks of so much mystery in terms of the natural world. For example, I use the example of, King Solomon, of George Washington, and of you and me. Now, King Solomon lived some 3,000 years ago, and I mean, you would find that he was able to travel at the speed of horse. He was able to communicate at the speed of hand-carried messenger. And he was able to feed and clothe himself, shelter himself with the natural elements that he would find around him, rocks, trees, wood, things like that. Advanced, you know, 2,700 years in the future at George Washington's day. Over that span of human history, George Washington was able to communicate at the speed of hand carried messenger, travel at the speed of horseback, you know, and also clothe and shelter himself with his natural elements. Now, if you just jump 200 years later, we are able to travel at the speed of sound or beyond with modern airplanes. We're able to communicate at the speed of light. And we can go in the laboratory and create polymers that can do, you know, artificial constructs that can do whatever we want. So in the last 150, 200 years, there's been a boom in scientific advance. It's been huge.
Mm-hmm.
Because of that, people have looked to science and said, wow, look at all this amazing thing that science can do. It seems like there's nothing that science can't do. And this is what we see as the undergirding attitude. Maybe they don't necessarily voice that specifically, but they tend to hold that idea, so much so that even in our commercials, you know, if you want to sell laundry detergent, you put a guy in a white lab coat in front of the people and you say, this product gets your clothes whiter than that product because of the science behind it. So science has been elevated to the level of Superman, I would say, in a white coat, able to fix almost anything. And this is where scientism comes in, because now what's happened, the new atheist movement has really been pushing scientism, but it's undergirded a lot of popular culture. It's the idea that science is now the only way we can find out things or know things. And when you believe science is the only way to find out or know things, that's where we start talking about scientism.
I often like to refer to what I call as the new priesthood. That in the medieval period, which wasn't the Dark Ages, and if anyone wants to know why it wasn't, go back and listen to my interview of James Hannum last year, or read his book, God's Philosophers, but it really was a time of advancement back then that was laying the groundwork for science, but the priesthood would have been seen as the highest authority. Now, today, the scientists of a new priest, and even when they speak on things that are not in their area, they're still considered authorities.
Yes, that's exactly right. Matter of fact, I have two quotes here that highlight that. Stephen Hawking, in his book with Leonard Plotnikov, The Grand Design, has said that scientists have become the bearers of the torch of discovery for quest knowledge. Matter of fact, he says philosophy is dead. It's the scientists who are making all of the advances. So that's one example. Another is, of course, Richard Dawkins, who would start asking him about things like, you know, but why should these reactions occur? Why should there be anything? Dawkins dismisses those and says, the why questions are just silly questions. He says, quote, those who believe in God like to point to the origin of the universe and say, well, science can't explain the Big Bang, or scientists can't explain where the laws of physics come from. He then quotes and says, physicists are working on that. That's what scientists do. They don't lie down and pathetically say, oh, we don't understand it, so God did it. Scientists actually work on the problem. They set to work. They roll up their sleeves and they work on the problem. One day, physics will answer those deep questions. Mm-hmm. And even if it doesn't, even if physics doesn't answer those questions, what on earth makes you think religion can? So here's Dawkins assuming that physics can answer the question, why is there something rather than nothing?
Mm-hmm.
And that's purely outside of the domain of physics. That's clearly not what physics does.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what you say, is if they become a high priesthood. And again, it used to be the Bells of St. Mary. Who was the hero in that? It was a Bing Crosby, was a bright guy in a priest's calling. Now it has to be a guy in a lab coat who solves the problem and has all the answers. You never see people coming to a priest in modern movie making. It's always the scientist who figures it out. And that's part of the problem that I'm worried about. Scientism is rampant. Of course, the new atheist, as I say, highlights. But you'd be surprised how many Christians assume it without realizing that they believe
it. You know, one thing I would stress in this is that on one side, I would agree with Dawkins. I don't think it's proper for us to say, we don't have an answer to this question, therefore, God did it. Yeah, I'm opposed to God of the Gaps mentalities and telling me, hey, let's try and find out all the answers that we can through any means whatsoever. But at the same time, I also think we should realize that some questions just aren't in the domain of science, and that's nothing against science. Edward Fesser has used the analogy thing. If you're using a metal detector at the beach and you're trying to find coins or metals or things of that sort, it will work great. But if you're trying to find documents or plastic, the metal detector isn't going to work, and that's not because a metal detector is a bad object.
Right. And the way I said it, there's a meme out there, you know, that asks people, you know, what's one moral question that atheists can't answer? What's one thing that you know, you can't discover? And here's what I respond with that. It's like, you know, science can tell us how to clone a man. Science cannot tell us if we should. And that's where the problem comes in, is when we elevate this idea, we see that people take it too far, because it's done some good things, obviously. You know, smallpox has been eradicated from the planet, things like that. So
We're
it's really,
communicating.
that's right. So things have done work very well. But ultimately, the thing that you have to remember is that science is done by scientists, and scientists are people. And that means that science is not immune to bias, because scientists are not immune to bias. Scientists are not immune to deceit or greed, or scientists can, you know, lust for fame and power. Scientists are just like everybody else, and therefore, if science is not this somehow perfect idea of developing knowledge, because it can be corrupted since there's people involved.
I've been in a discussion lately with some people of the scientism mindset, and I've actually heard the charge that scientism doesn't really exist. It's a made-up name that theists use to label something that they're afraid of. Have you ever encountered that one?
No, I've not. I've heard some people say that the way I describe scientism may not exist. But heck, I've got the grand design right in front of me. You know, Stephen Hawking on page one says philosophy is this, and in the next three chapters, he almost exclusively talks about philosophical ideas. So what does that mean? I read you the Dawkins quote, and it's clearly that Dawkins is imbuing to physics something that's outside of the domain of physics. So if that isn't science, then what is?
Well, my research when I was looking into it was I actually found a paper by Piglucci, who is an atheist and no friend of Christianity, and wrote a paper critiquing the new atheism, I believe was published in a philosophical journal, and commenting on the problem of scientism. And he defined scientism in there pretty much the same way you and I would. So I showed these atheists I'm communicating with and said, well, I guess Piglucci is involved in this big religious cover-up right now then, isn't he?
Yeah, that was a paper last year in the Midwest Studies in Philosophy, and he did a great job in that paper. If you don't know Massimo Piglucci, he is an avowed atheist. He pushes for secularism in science. I mean, he's not somebody who's waffling or sitting on the fence. But he does offer in that paper three points as to why scientism fails. He writes, number one, that scientism is philosophically unsound. Number two, it does a disservice to real science. And number three, he says it does a disservice even to atheism. So that's Piglucci.
He actually been responsible for an event held at local university around here, the University of Tennessee, the event of Darwin Day that goes on regularly. And so
And
he's pretty well known in this very area. In fact, when I've been in these debates lately, one question I've been using to ask people who hold to scientism is, well, can you use science then and tell me what my favorite color is? And I've been quite amazed that you've I've seen atheists saying, well, I would rather trust the scientific test on what your favorite color is rather than a personal testimony.
Well, again, that shows the ignorance of those who are answering the question. Because if you ask any neurosurgeon or neurologist who will do an MRI scan, a PET scan, something on you know, where they would do imaging on the brain and how the brain works, what you'll find is that imaging really doesn't tell them what they need to know. The only way they know what they need to know is by first-hand account. They have to ask the person in the scanner to, say, think of their favorite color, and they see lights light up, but they have to say, were you thinking of it then? Those are first-hand, internal, immediate forms of knowledge that can only be discerned by asking the individual. Mm-hmm. The physiological response of love and the physiological response of fear are basically identical. You can't tell them apart by just measuring the sweat of your hand or the beating of your heart. You know, those two things chart out the same. What you have to do is you have to ask the person, are you afraid or are you Twitter patient? This is my point. This is why I want to make a deal about this, because Christians don't realize how much they believe things like MRIs can show you how your brain works. And it's simply not the case. An MRI is a generic kind of estimate of what's going on in your brain. It's not even exactly what's going on in your brain. But people assume that these things are true, and they take them to the next level.
Yeah. Something that we should stress also, to get that out of the way beforehand, is no one is advocating that we should be anti-science. And I've made it my point in my own apologetics that I don't address questions of science as science, because I'm not a scientist. I leave it to scientists. But if science can give me any good reason to really show that something is true, then I think we should believe it until we have reason otherwise, because science is just as much meant to show us God's truth as anything else is.
Yes, I completely agree with you. I'm not, and please don't let anybody think that I'm somehow persuading you from either going into a scientific field or trusting in science, where science has said something that understandable, provable, and replicable. What I'm trying to, well, let me give you a picture. The idea is, have you ever watched some of those bad 50s B horror movies? They all seem to run kind of the same way, where you have, you know, maybe the good doctor who's well-respected in his town. All of a sudden, his evil twin shows up, who's also, you know, studied science. And the evil twin wants to take over the town. And so he substitutes himself for the good doctor, and he starts manipulating things to serve his own purposes, to build himself up. I think scientism is the evil twin of science. Mm-hmm. And if the key here is to, you know, follow the plot closely enough so that you recognize the signs. Usually in these B movies, you see by the third act, the guy becomes so self-absorbed that it's clearly easy to discern he is not the original guy that we were looking for. And he serves himself rather than the community. You see all of this stuff, and that's what I'm trying to say. I want to make sure that we're protecting ourselves against the evil twin of scientism and not good science.
Mm. You know, when it comes to watching those old movies, I can't guarantee you I've watched them aside from maybe Mystery Science Theater, perhaps. Does that count?
Yeah, maybe, but it's just kind of a nice picture that people can see. For example, scientism believes only its own rules apply, that you can make assumptions on why questions, where science would say, no. Science is based on observational data, experiment, hypotheses, and whether that hypothesis is testable. Ideas like that are clear where science starts and stops. And scientism says, no, we can talk about why there's something rather than nothing. We can redefine the idea of nothing. We can talk about what's meaningful and what's not. Those are clearly outside of the parameters of science, and that's what I mean when I say scientism starts to believe its own rules apply.
Yeah, I'm thinking about Lawrence Krauss's book right now about a universe from nothing, which I've read, and the science in it, I mean, I'm not going to argue against. I don't know the science, so everything in there could be legit. But then when he starts talking about what nothing really is, he completely redefines what is meant by nothing. If you went to the Middle Ages, for instance, where this question was being debated and asked, what do you mean by nothing? Or was it absolute non-existence, nothing positive whatsoever can be said about it, just simply as something that is not. And Krauss doesn't take that thing, so he pretty much changes the whole question and says, hey, look, I've come up with an answer.
Right, and that's the problem where it's not necessarily his calculations that are wrong, it's his presuppositions that are wrong. And that's the problem. Science, for example, owes a debt to philosophy.
Right.
Now, if you think about this first, the scientific method is all about proving or disproving whether a certain theory works. That means that there's inference to the best explanation with a philosophical principle. There's the law of non-contradiction, which kicks in, which is a philosophical principle. Science assumes that you'll be truthful in your results, that you won't fudge the results. So there's moral implications that happen.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we see. Paul Davies, who is an astrophysicist over at Arizona State University, has an interesting quote. He says, quote, over the years, I've often asked my physicist colleagues why the laws of physics are what they are. The answers vary from, that's not a scientific question, to nobody knows. But the favorite reply is, there is no reason they are what they are. They just are. And then David goes on to say, the idea that the laws exist reasonlessly is deeply anti-rational. After all, the very essence of a scientific explanation of some phenomenon is that the world is ordered logically. Now, that's a Christian concept, that the world is ordered logically.
Mm-hmm.
And that there are reasons things are as they are. One traces these reasons all the way down to the bedrock of reality, philosophy, only to find that reason then deserts us, it makes a mockery of science, end quote.
Mm-hmm.
So there's Davy saying that we need the philosophy of why in order to make our science of how valuable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and when we look at church history, for instance, the more and more we found out about how God made the universe, starting with people like Copernicus and Galileo and Kepler and Newton and others, it wasn't that they make a discovery and say, darn it, God's out of a job right then. Instead, they made a discovery and thought, wow, this is the way the Creator did it. That's incredible. They didn't see themselves as filling gaps and leaving less room for God. They saw themselves as explaining the methods of God.
That's right. Thinking God's thoughts after him.
Mm-hmm.
Matter of fact, Thomas Aquinas in his Five Ways, he talks about the existence of God, the last way, fifth way. He writes, taken from the governance of the world, we see that things which lack knowledge, such as natural bodies, act for an end. And this is evident they're acting always or nearly always in the same way so as to obtain the best result. Aquinas is saying there's a telos, there's a way they do this, and there's a consistency, and we have to point to God for that consistency. He says, it's plain that they achieve their end not fortuitously, but because they're designed to do so. Whatever lacks knowledge can't prove toward an end unless it be directed by some being endowed with knowledge and intelligence, as an arrow is directed by the archer. Therefore, some intelligent being exists by whom all natural things are directed to their end. This being is what we call God. So there's Aquinas thing. And this is interesting. That means also that modern science, as we understand it, owes a debt to theology.
Mm-hmm.
I think in a recent interview, Dr. Timothy McGrew made that same point where he said, you know, if you look at the scientific advancements in the Far East, China, or in the Arabic nation, they were actually ahead of us in certain developments, such as the printing press, the invention of gunpowder, calculus, things like that. And Dr. McGrew says, but they stagnated because there was no idea that the earth is discoverable and God is an orderly God who would set the world in such a way that it's dependable and you can find out and think God's thoughts after him by doing scientific research.
It's something important to stress as a fan of Thomas Aquinas and his Five Ways, and Edward Fessler brings this out very well in his book Aquinas and in his book The Last Superstition, that too often the new atheists looked, especially Richard Dawkins, looked at the fifth way and said, oh, that's your modern intelligent design movement. And he says, no, Aquinas wouldn't have cared about that at all. He has nothing to do with intelligent design in the sense that, well, look at how well these cells are made. Look at the internal makeup of these. No, he's talking about purpose entirely. So if you just had one electron orbiting a nucleus, you'd have all you needed for Aquinas' argument.
Yes, exactly. The idea that, again, in anything there's a telos, there's an end, there's a purpose that's shown toward the existence of things that we are. We don't live in a bland... It's the difference between a radio signal and static, if you will. Static is white noise. It's a whole bunch of different frequencies, but there's no order, there's no purpose in it. So what happens is, second law of thermodynamics, right? Everything degrades into randomness. This is what we have here. We have randomness disorder, and eventually you'll just lose all energy whatsoever. Whereas a radio signal, you're putting something into the system. You're putting an intelligent concept, a mind behind the system, in order to make that signal unique, and discernible. So whether it's as you say, you know, an electron orbiting a hydrogen atom, or the Earth orbiting the Sun, or the expansion of the universe itself, there seems to be a telos to all of it that allows say for higher life.
You're certainly correct also about the idea of theology being essential, because theology grounds the philosophy. I was saying there's a mind there that's in charge of everything. Philosophy was seen as the handmaiden to theology in the medieval period. There is a chart you can find online. It's this meme where it's got this supposed progress of science, and there's this blank spot card for Dark Ages, and then everything takes up again, say, around the time of the Enlightenment, and such, and says, imagine, we could have been traveling to other planets by now. And I personally prefer the response that Tim O'Neill did in his review of a book, God's Philosophers, on his website, Armarium Magnum, where he calls that meme the stupidest thing on the internet ever. And before anyone starts screaming bias, it's important to point out Tim O'Neill is an atheist.
Yeah, that's obviously a very biased view of history, and anybody who would do any digging onto some of the advancements that happened between 500 and 1500 AD would find that the meme itself isn't true. But, I mean, even today, people think that, well, those may be the Dark Ages, but now look at how much farther we've come. Mm-hmm. Science can tell us everything. Well, no, it really can't. There are other ways of knowing, and we neglect those other ways of knowing if we believe that science is the only way to know anything else. For example, we have immediate knowledge, and we talked about this before. When I wake up in the morning, I don't have to hook myself up to an EEG machine to make sure I'm alive.
Yeah.
You know, I don't have to do science to know that I'm actually living today, or you know, what I had for breakfast last night or yesterday morning, something like that. Mm-hmm. Did I have a dream? How do I know it was a dream and it wasn't reality? You know, science can't tell you that, because if you look at the mind, the memory is the memory, right? There's no way to distinguish it, but there's a tangibility that you know as an individual. So things like that as well start to play into this. And that's why I, again, caution folks. I mean, we talk even today, like I say, if I go to a church, and I start talking to people, a lot of people will believe that their mind is something akin to their brain, the processes and reactions that are going on in their brain. They don't understand that the Christian view of a human being is that they are a two-part entity. They have a soul as well as a body, and that the processes of the mind are actually part of the soul. Those things happen there, intentionality, will, things like that. They're non-physical, they're non-physical. So they're expressed through the body. The mind sees that data, or the brain receives that data directly. And there's an inner same way computers, hardware, and software interface with each other. But you are not your brain. You are more than your brain. You are body and soul. And we do a disservice when we start assuming that, say, neuroscientists are the ones to turn to when we see these horrific school shootings and things like that. It may very well be that we need a spiritual leader to talk about sin as opposed to a neuroscientist to talk about a damaged brain.
Yeah, and my wife and I are both Aspies, so we know what it's like to have brains that function a little bit differently than most other people do. But whenever I hear about these school shootings, and they always talk where there was a chemical imbalance and things like that, well, maybe to some extent there was. No one should rule it out. No doubt that happens sometimes. But could also be a lot of times people are just evil, and maybe we should blame, I should say, yeah, maybe the person actually did something wrong.
Yeah, exactly. And realize, again, there's a connection. For example, if I look at my computer, if I damage the video card of my computer, that's hardware. Now, I start trying to type, I don't know, a letter or something like that, it's going to look wrong on the screen if my video card is damaged. Or if I damage the hard drive, even when I try to save that, I'm going to get a garbled mess. I'm not going to get what I wanted to save. Now, that's not because the software is bad. That's because the hardware is corrupting the interface between the two. And sometimes that goes wrong. So can people seem to have personality differences because there's a physical ailment? Absolutely. Can chemistry in the brain cause things like depression? Well, sure it can, because it's a two-way interaction. But just like hardware can damage the net result when you're at your computer, it doesn't mean that the software is bad. It means that the hardware is corrupting what the software is trying to do. And so we could see A, bad software, which is, as you say, people are evil, basically. Or B, the hardware corrupts the software and makes people think they're perceiving something different than they are. So they're both true, but that doesn't mean that we discount one off for the sake of the other.
Yeah, and one thing that should be stressed, since we could be getting into some psychology here, is that there is in no way saying, for instance, that people should avoid, say, psychological medications, such if they have some sort of condition. My wife had to take antidepressants for several years, and I've known people that are pretty high up in the scholarly field who've just gone through a difficult time, and for that time at least, they needed to take something to help deal with that depression, because if that chemical imbalance is there, sometimes before you can get to where you can really hear the rational side of your mind, you have to get some treatment. And it's the exact same way that the Salvation Army have the idea of soup, soap, salvation, because if a person you're sitting there trying to share the gospel to is sitting there starving, they're not going to hear your words. They're going to hear their stomach the whole time.
Right. Exactly that. And that was, that's definitely the point that I want to make, is that, again, there's nothing wrong with saying, hey, there seems to be a chemical imbalance in your brain, so some medication is necessary in order to correct that. I'm not saying that won't help, because I think it's very well made, but it's not the end of the issue, neither is it the only way to understand motivations and things like that. There is a real soul that people have, and they really mix up the concept of the mind and the brain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, David Burns, I believe, in his book Feeling Good, said that there was a case study done with using just cognitive therapy on one group and just using medications on another group. And at the end of the study, cognitive therapy won out. I think part of it is, if we try to psychologize sin, we sadly remove a person from being able to be responsible for their actions and be able to say, you can change this, you can work past it. And no one's saying it's going to be easy. A lot of times. Many times, it won't be. You pretty much have to totally redo your way of thinking. And some people will never get off of medication. That's fine. But they can accept the degree of of responsibility they have for their own actions, too.
Right, right. And this is part of why the threat of scientism is so dangerous, because it ignores certain causal factors that could be the necessary condition or something. And how do you treat a sinner if you don't recognize the idea of sin?
Mm-hmm.
You know, then you're not treating the disease, you're just simply treating the system, symptoms.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you make the guy stop sneezing, but he's still infected. And that's the problem with things of scientism. It really does a disservice to who we are as individuals, because really scientism boils people down to their material components.
Mm-hmm.
They reject the supernatural. They would reject any kind of idea of a metaphysical reality beyond the physical, and that's a problem. So we see that kind of thing. Like I said, science gives us a way to achieve, but it's dumb on whether the achievement is worth. It can tell us how to clone someone. It can't tell us if we should. And those are key issues. Even if we look at a cost-benefit analysis, there's a famous moral dilemma that in ethics class they use all the time about an idea of a man who's one man who's hurt in an accident. He comes in first. The doctor starts working on him. He's hurt really badly, but he can be saved. There are five other men sitting in other rooms waiting for that doctor. Each one of them would surely die, but if they would receive the organ transplant of this first gentleman who's ill, then they could all live. Would it be better for the doctor to save the five by taking the organs from the one?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and science would say, well, if you can, 5-1, it seems like a better ratio, but do we want to live in a society like that? What if the guy on the table is a mass murderer and the other five individuals are scientists working on a cure for cancer? You know, would that still warrant the doctor letting the man on the table in front of him die so he could take his organs? Put them in these other five guys and they can live. So how does science answer that question? There's simply no way that science can do that with any kind of justification and come up with an answer that would be appropriate for us to take as a moral good. And those are the kinds of things that, again, I see. This is why this is a big issue. And I worry that folks in the church don't realize how much they assume, because our popular culture puts it out there, that science is the savior. Where they, you know, maybe they take Stephen Jay Gould's idea of non-overlapping magisteria, where science is in this box, religion is in that box, which you never touch. Well, the science says that we can do organ transplants, so the two are touching. Now what are we doing?
Yeah, I'm also thinking about how this works with moral issues. For instance, we can ask, what if we find a genetic link with homosexuality one day, for instance? What if we find a gene for homosexuality, see? Yeah? What if you find one? So what? That doesn't tell you anything other than, well, this is genetic. You could find genes for several other behaviors, and it doesn't say whether those behaviors are right or wrong. I mean, if I found a gene that makes people who have it more loving of their neighbors, would we then say, for instance, well, that has to be good because there's a gene for it? Or would we just say, no, that's just good on its own?
Right, exactly. I use the example of kleptomania.
Mm-hmm.
Well, kleptomania may very well have a biological component.
Mm-hmm.
But if it has a biological component, that doesn't mean we open up all of our stores and they could take what you like.
Mm-hmm.
It means that we treat the kleptomania because it has a biological component. We can treat it in certain ways, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't mean that it excuses the behavior. And I find this argument is actually interesting in regards to homosexuality, because it's backwards of the way people have viewed Civilization has never been, hey, look, this is your biological drive, so act on it. That's what dogs do. That's what animals do.
Mm-hmm.
People curve, right? I mean, red-blooded college boys have a biological urge to copulate. That doesn't mean that we let them do so. We tell them, you have to be a civilized human being, and you have to control those urges. You don't react on those urges. You curb them. And so only in homosexuality does this argument get flipped on its head and say, well, therefore it's okay.
Mm-hmm. It doesn't make any sense. Yeah, I'm also thinking, since you brought up animals, that there's a meme I've seen going around that says something like, say, homosexuality exists in 430 different species, or whatever number it is.
Right.
Homophobia exists in only one. Which one do you think is natural now? And I always like to come out and say, well, rationality, as we know it, exists only in human beings. Therefore, it's not natural to be rational.
Yeah. These are the silliest arguments that the internet is usually peppered with. Mm-hmm. And I don't understand. So what, 430? First of all, it's not homosexuality. It's not the same thing. Same sex, with animals, it's self-stimulation. Because they don't care what the sex of the other animal is, or if it's an animal at all.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a dog, will find a person's leg as much as another dog. So that's not the same thing as two people looking for a same-sex thrill.
Mm-hmm.
It's a completely different piece. But by that regard, so what? Bipedalism is in the minority in the animal kingdom as well. Should we start walking on all fours? I mean, what's the point of all that? It doesn't prove anything one way or the other, as you said.
Mm-hmm.
It's a diversion, not truly an objection.
And when I wanted to discuss it, since if we talk about the effects, now that is certainly a scientific issue. So what I've done most of the time is I've gone straight to the Center for Disease Control website, looked it in, and brought up what they've said there about risk and getting yourself checked for STDs, things of that sort, and said, well, there you go. The CDC must be religiously motivated or something.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I've made that comparison as well. It's interesting that the idea of smoking,
mm-hmm.
the CDC has done studies, and they've shown that there's somewhere around 25% higher, 24% higher risk of developing lung cancer. Men develop lung cancer 23 times more, and women develop lung cancer 13 times more by smoking than not smoking. So we put large warning labels on cigarettes. But if you go to the same CDC site, what you see is that men who have sex with men are at risk of 150 times higher risk of contracting AIDS than those who don't. Now, that's not 13 times to 23 times. It's 150 times higher. And that's the CDC's own finding. So much so that they've got a separate subsection on their website talking about specifically men who have sex with men and the dangers inherent in that. So, yeah, if you want to talk science, that's science. That's talking about what's actually the case versus what you want it to be. But, again, it's easy to ignore that because, really, that's driven by a different motivation than
your... Yeah. I interviewed last year, Michelle, Robert Gagnon. He's the author of the book, The Bible and Homosexual Practice, and in the appendices and the other parts at the end, he's got a section where he talks about, what if I told you there was a behavior, if you do it, you're more likely to X, Y, Z, all these, and it's just horrible, horrible effects, and he's thinking, well, geez, I didn't know homosexuality was this bad, and he says, actually, this isn't homosexuality, this is alcoholism. Homosexuality is worse. Many of this what those are.
Oh, really? That's interesting.
Yeah.
Same idea. So, we deal with biases all the time. That's kind of the overarching concept that I try to talk about when I talk about science versus science.
Mm-hmm.
We need to talk better and explain the differences better, I think, in our churches. So that those folks who are in the pew can understand the difference, can spot the difference between science and scientism,
mm-hmm.
and perhaps can talk to their friends and family and say, well, that's not true. There's other ways we can know things. There's other ways we can... I mean, I remember I was having lunch one day and with a lady, and she's a professional woman. She's, gone through college. She's very intelligent. did her job well, and she told me at lunch that there was, you know, we can't know truth. Can't know truth? We can't know any truth. There's no way we can know truth. Well, how do you know that, you know? And she goes, no, just any truths are unknowable. I said, well, you know, what about the Earth is 93 million miles away from the sun, or 2 + 2 = 4? She goes, well, those are facts. Those aren't truth. That's different. So we have this confusion here of folks who really think that there's some kind of distinction between scientific knowledge and other kinds of knowledge, where scientific knowledge is knowable, other kinds of knowledge is not. And that's a false dichotomy, because, again, scientific knowledge relies on mathematics, for example, in order to achieve its results. It's mathematics. If we can't know, you know, mathematical truth, then we can't know scientific truth, at least as they purport to anything that has a formula driving it. And we have to, again, rely on moral truths. We have to rely on philosophical truths in order to make all those things.
I'm thinking about on last week's Unbelievable, which Unbelievable is one of those podcasts that I always listen to, and he had James Croft, the atheist, debating on there, and one statement he may have been in with that, but Justin asked him, says, so you're saying your views are true? And he's saying, no, I'm not saying they're true. I'm saying they're useful. And I just almost fell out of my chair when I heard that.
How do you know they're even useful? Useful means that there's some true result that comes from them.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, how do you even know that? That doesn't make any sense at all.
Yeah.
And this is the interesting thing. Ultimately, scientism starts to chase its own tail, starts to cut itself down. Because, as I say, there's no science that you can do to prove that all truth is the only truth that's worth knowing is discoverable. There's no scientific way of determining that. You can't boil anything in a beaker and have the smoke come out. The only scientific truths are worth knowing, things like that. So it's really self-refuting in that regard. Whereas that's what we see today, and that's what we're chasing more and more. And it's sometimes it's an unspoken presupposition, but it is there. And it needs to be teased out and explained and shown to be false. I think one of the best ways we can do this in the church is to, number one, demonstrate that truth does exist outside of science. And, you know, people love. How do we know that people love? Well, we don't do science to find that out. We ask them directly.
Mm-hmm.
We know that moral truths are true, even if we don't know how they're true. You know, how we came to the knowledge of killing babies for fun is always wrong. We don't have necessarily a roadmap to argue, you know, here's how I came to that conclusion. We may simply know it, but we know that it's true. And so I think there's ways that we can show that there are truths that exist outside of science. And secondly, I think we can simply argue, you know what, scientists are people too, and because they're people too, they're fallible as well. A very interesting book that's just come out on the whole idea of high fat as those things, I don't know if you've been following any kind of nutritional thing, but it's been said for, since the 1950s maybe, that if you eat a high-fat diet, especially fats that come from foods like meat and cheese and things like that, if you eat that kind of a diet, that's going to be bad for your heart. And that's really based off of one guy who was pushing the idea of high fat. It fit his theory, and he discarded some information, kept others, and then he went on a campaign to argue for his position, so much so that first the American Heart Association accepted it, and then more broadly the government put it in their federal nutrition guidelines. And now all of the science that's coming out of saying is completely wrong, and it's a pretty interesting study. The book is entitled The Big Fat Surprise, Why Butter, Meat, and Cheese Belong in a Healthy Diet. I'm not necessarily pushing the diet so much. I'm interested in how the theory developed. And if you think that this story is interesting and how one individual who can be captivating and personable can make a wrong theory mainstream, it turn it into consensus. Then you've got to wonder about other theories, say like the Neo-Darwinian synthesis, that are also mainstream because they have a pretty high risk or pretty high, they're playing for pretty high stakes, I should say. Because of that, you know, are they capable of being misleading the science? Absolutely so.
Well, I've still always made my stance now that I don't really debate the evolution question just because I'm not a scientist. At the same time, I do think, you know, if you want to debate evolution, for instance, and I tell Krista, if you want to debate evolution, just do this. Make sure it's a science debate. Because if evolution is to fall, it needs to fall because it's bad science. And if it's bad science, you can demonstrate that scientifically. And I'm also thinking of what you were saying just now about sort of about how one man's idea took hold. I can't help but think of G.K. Chesterton's famous quote that he who marries the spirit of the age is destined to be a widow.
Yes, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
I love Chesterton.
Mm-hmm. And it's important to point out that while scientism should be opposed, there certainly are questions that, yeah, we should go to the scientist to answer. If my wife were to come in here and saying, "Hun, I don't feel good, my head's hurting, I've got a stomachache, I've got this pain on my side," I'm not going to say, "Well, hun, go open up the book of Jeremiah and read the 12th chapter and then we're going to pray together." I'm going to say, "Okay, let's call the doctor and make an appointment."
Right. Science is a tool.
Yep.
It is a tool for knowledge, and we can discern knowledge from it, but it is neither the only tool nor the preferred one in every situation.
And in fact, we as good Christians, we should be supporting science, because unfortunately too often it has been rightfully deserved that Christians have been seen as anti-science. I don't think we were in the medieval period and times like that, but today there are too many Christians that I wouldn't mean who would say, "Yeah, I'm afraid they're anti-science," and when they are, and they give the rest of us a bad name.
Yeah, they're, what happened was, I think in the 20th century, instead of, you know, and this is part of the fundamentalist backlash,
yep,
things like that, where what you had was a bunch of Christians that said, "Well, those people in the academy, they're saying that, you know, the Bible is unreliable, that science ruling the day," things like that. And instead of meeting them on their own intellectual high ground, they retreated into their churches. And
yeah,
they did that both theologically by not arguing against those bad presuppositions of the documentary hypothesis, things like that. And they also did it scientifically. They just pulled back and they let the atheists, they let the secular take the day at that.
Yeah, and what I've told people is, if we're going to be people that follow the evidence where it leads, we don't come in, we start arguing that this has to be wrong because it already disagrees with our conclusions that we've heard prior. Well, if we've been believing something that's wrong, and the evidence can show that, well, let it show that. We should all want to know if we're believing something that's wrong, but we shouldn't make any statements on what the evidence is going to be, what the conclusion would be, until we've actually really looked at the evidence.
Yeah, and we can have some surprising confirmations. I mean, the quote by Robert Jastrow, who's the astrophysicist at NASA, you know, rings in my ears, where he said, you know, scientists have for centuries sought to understand the beginning of the universe, and here in the 20th century, as we're climbing over that last peak, as we scale the mountaintop with our work and we get ready to ascend to the highest point, we look over and we find ourselves a band of theologians who've been sitting there for millennia.
Yeah.
So, you know, sometimes the science, such as the Big Bang, and I tell a lot of people, for example, the Big Bang is nothing that a Christian should be afraid of, because all the Big Bang says is the universe began to exist at some point in the past out of nothing. That's a good theological point that we want to hold on to.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes the science can actually bolster our views as opposed to detract from it.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to take a break for now because we've reached that point in our show. And when we come back, we're going to be talking about college ministry. I am Nick Peters of Deeper Waters Podcast. My guest is Lenny Esposito of Come Reason Ministries. We'll be back after this break.
It's here, the official Grok Radio mobile app. Listen to your favorite Grok Radio programs on your iPhone, iPad, iPod, Kindle Fire, Android smartphones, and tablets. The best thing is, it's absolutely free. Download it now from the iTunes or Google Play App Store, or get a link at our website, cyiworldwide.com. Grok Radio, Christian radio that doesn't suck.
Check out cyiworldwide.com, home of Grok Radio. Free music downloads, advice, prayer, and support. cyiworldwide.com. Do you grok?
Hey, this is Minister Grok. Thanks for listening. Although Grok Radio is free, there are costs to upkeep the website, podcast, and purchase Bibles and materials for street ministry. And while we are happy to pay this ourselves out of pocket, we will gladly accept any gifts if you feel led to support the shows and our street ministry. You can send a gift or love offering through our website at cyiworldwide.com. Thanks for your support, and God bless.
Check out cyiworldwide.com. cyiworldwide.com, home of Grok Radio. Free music downloads, advice, prayer, and support. cyiworldwide.com. Do you grok?
Can't get enough of your favorite Grok Radio shows? Well, now you can download episodes for free. Check out the Grok Radio program archive at cyiworldwide.com.
And we're back to the show. We're with Lenny Esposito of Come Reason Ministries. We spent the last hour talking about scientism and science. We're going to be talking about college campus ministries this hour. But if you're here next week, my friend Trevor Ray Sloan is going to be on. He's going to be talking about a book he's written on doing winsome apologetics. Could be a really interesting back and forth we have with each other as we discuss apologetic methods and probably also his own podcast, Think It Through, which I was a guest on last month, so go and try and listen to that episode. I talked about the resurrection from a social science perspective. But for now, we've got Lenny Esposito here, and we're talking about now college campus ministry. Now, Lenny, I was emailing someone this week. I found a book of hers, and I was going to email her about it, and she emailed back, and I mentioned having Asperger's, and Marion said, oh, my son has Asperger's too, and he recently came home from college, and he has a master's, and I'm so proud of him, but he also came home and said that he no longer believes in God. And she shared me some of the reasons I gave, and I'm looking and thinking, these seem pretty basic to me, but, you know, unfortunately, that story, it's all too common, isn't it?
And again, in our society, we have an interesting, of course, we've developed the idea of the adolescent, which in social history hasn't really been a major contention. People were either, you know, children or they were adults. Now, as young adults, right, think of the bar mitzvah as an example. It's just one culture's way of transitioning individuals from childhood to adulthood. And what adulthood meant was that you started being responsible for yourself and taking on the responsibilities of the community, you know, as well. And that started, we recognized that 13-year-old boys, you know, couldn't take on all of their responsibilities, but we expected them to acclimate themselves and start striving toward adulthood at that time. Now, nowadays, there's a big chunk in the middle from 13 to 18 or so that we call adolescence, which is kind of this in-between phase of not childhood, but still a lot of very playful. You're developing your mind, but you're not necessarily taking on the responsibilities of adulthood yet. So when kids take college, it is really the first time they are treated as adults on an adult level. It's the time where they've separated themselves from their parents many times, staying in dorms and places away from their support system, which means that they're usually moved out of the house, they've moved away from their home church and the support system that's there. And now they have been given life, become an adult, but they really haven't had a whole lot of training in that. And so you see a lot of the kids in college run amok. They have this freedom, they have this license, they don't have the experience of responsibility that should have been cultivated through those last 5-6 years go with it. And so they're trying to figure it all out at once. They're trying to figure it out for themselves. They've got the pressures of budgeting and the pressures of new school and things like that. And they've got to figure out what the spiritual aspects of their lives are as well. Mm-hmm. And that's the struggle that we see. Now, because we, as I said in the last hour, abandoned the academy to the secularists then see this as an opportunity to indoctrinate that new set of human beings into a worldview that is similar to their own. And that's unfortunately what we see over and over and over again. And there's a lot of problems that I think we can fix. The churches, there's things that the church has neglected, which I think we can help soften some of that. But really, that's the piece that you have to be careful of. And that's one of the reasons why I love college ministry. It's because people are asking their own questions for the first time. And unfortunately, most universities are only giving you one side of the answer that plays well against secularism and not against the historic Christian.
Yeah, one aspect of their freedom that I don't think you mentioned, but I think we should point out also, it's first time they seem to have some sort of moral freedom as well. And a lot of the whole sexual revolution comes in, Ben, and that's also a major reason for the apostasies that we see.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, again, they're trying to figure all of this out, and they're getting messages from their friends that sexual looseness is not only okay, but almost expected, right? So your wild oats in college years kind of idea. So we see this over and over again, and that's a problem.
Mm-hmm.
But what concerns me is they will face two kinds of difficulties with professors that are things that the church should be working more and more on. I don't know if you've seen the movie God's Not Dead.
Oh, yes.
Most people who are interested in apologetics have at least not seen it. Kevin Sorbo plays this hard antagonistic philosophy professor who's basically in your face challenging the Christian to confront his worldview. And I've seen those folks. I know that they're there. I completely, some people have asked me, well, isn't that a caricature? The movie may be a little bit two-dimensional, but that type of individual does actually exist. And I've talked with kids who've had those kinds of problems. Matter of fact, last year, I had a young freshman who said, my intro to philosophy professor will allow me to talk about Genesis. He wants me to support creation. He's going to give me 20 minutes of class time to do it. So it's like the exact same scenario, which was an interesting. But what concerns me more is the second kind of professors that I've come in contact with. And those are the guys who are not as belligerent or in your face. They offer questions. And if you want, have you thought that perhaps this may be another way of looking at things? And I just got an email, matter of fact, this week from a girl. And she's studying English. This is an English 101 class at a community college, okay? Required class. Everybody has to take it. And she came on, and she sent me this assignment. The very first assignment was 10% of their grade, where the prof said, I want you to write a definitional essay or explanatory essay coming up with a new, interesting, or surprising definition of marriage. And you can provide examples and this and that, but I'm going, why does the definition of marriage need to be new and surprising? Who says that we can define marriage in a new and surprising way? So that's a very subtle assignment, a subtle way of saying that marriage can be defined by the end user as opposed to marriage as a descriptor of what our natural biology leads. So that difference is subtle and distinct, but it gets people thinking in one way so that by the time they're seniors, all of a sudden, they have assumed a secular worldview and they've not even known it.
So how did you encourage this girl to respond?
Well, I talked to her about the idea that marriage is not merely, I mean, because she could write it any way she wants, I gave her supporting documentation, Brian Anderson on the Ruth Institute and some other folks that talk about marriage as the only recognized union in society, the only function where we can, where children are a result, where rearing the next generation can happen. So marriage is a bonding of a man and woman where the natural outgrowth of that would be to produce offspring into fully formed members of society. Mm-hmm. And I gave her some data on where to find that and how to argue it from a natural perspective that is as much biologically based as it is, religiously based. You can argue the religious point. I don't think secular professors will accept that, or even maybe secular students who are her peers will accept that. But if you argue it from a natural perspective, that there is no other institution in all of humanity that allows for the next generation to flourish other than marriage, then we've got something that we can talk about being a man and a woman, things like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, you were talking about how we are not doing better to prepare our students, and I agree entirely. There is a failure on the part of our church on disciple making and intellectually preparing. Before the show, you asked me how I got started in apologetics, and I said, "Well, when I was in Bible college, I found out." And I look back at my lot of times, and I think, "And why didn't anyone tell me about this beforehand?" I grew up in the church all my life. No one said a single thing about it.
Right, and that's one of the problems I think that modern Christianity has, is they misunderstand and they really don't believe in their youth.
Mm-hmm.
They really underestimate the ability of a young person comprehend these hard issues. Matter of fact, I would say that we have a big problem when our youth ministry becomes entertainment as opposed to education. And I'm not talking about merely taking a Bible story and deriving 3 points from it. Kids, even as young as 13, like I said, this adolescent phase is kind of an artificial one. They start asking these big questions of life early. They're capable of doing so. We've sheltered them from it. So youth groups tend to be, how can we placate the young people of our day because they just keep coming back?
Mm-hmm.
So it becomes pizza parties and movie nights.
Yeah.
And that's what youth groups start to look like. I think we need to turn that around. Now, one of the things that I've done, we worked a little bit with Brett Kunkel on this and developed our own version of it, is we take our kids on apologetic missions. Start from freshman in high school all the way through college. And what we do is we train them. We teach them about the existence of God, about objections. You know, here's an objection you would hear. How would you answer that? Then we pick them up and we put them in a place where they're definitely going to hear it. For example, UC Berkeley. We will go on campus at UC Berkeley and we will talk to the kids at UC Berkeley and have our kids talk to their kids and interact. Or we'll bring out an atheist. We'll bring out a Richard Carrier or something like that. And he will address our students. We'll say, you're an atheist. I'm going to give you 20 minutes with our church group, and we won't say a word. Now, what atheist wouldn't love to have that opportunity?
Mm-hmm.
He makes his presentation. But then our kids get to ask him questions afterwards and find out what the support is for his contention.
Mm-hmm.
And you see, that has changed so many people. We've done this at Berkeley. We've done this in Utah. We've gone to Dearborn, Michigan, where we've done it with Muslim populations.
Mm-hmm.
And when the kids get actually out there and able to interface one-on-one with people, it's an amazing response. I remember there were two girls, they were, I think, sophomores in high school. So fairly young girls, 15, 16. We were on this campus at Berkeley, and they approached two guys who were biomed majors. Now, if you know anything about Berkeley, it's a tough school. got to be on your game. So Biomed is going to be even tougher. And they were nervous talking to these guys. After 30, 40 minutes, they came back with big old smiles on their faces, and they said, you can't even tell us where morality comes from.
Mm-hmm.
And they felt so much more confident in their Christian faith because they could see that the atheistic worldview had no answer. They were so confident that I don't have to worry about those girls going to any school. And let's face it, if you faced off against a Richard Carrier, there's nothing your college professor is going to say that's going to surprise you. You've heard it all, and you know that there are answers to all of it. So this is one of the ways that we instill in our youth the confidence as well as the intellectual acumen to resist these kinds of attacks, to see them before they come. We train them, and that's how we do it.
Yeah, I'm thinking that you could have some parent out there who's listening or something, where if you bring in an atheist to the class and have them actually dialogue with students, the students could be persuaded by their arguments. They don't need to hear those arguments, and I'd be thinking, your students are already either hearing those arguments or they're going to hear those arguments.
That's right. That's exactly right. You don't send a major league ball player to face a major league pitcher without putting him in the batter's box first, controlling the environment so that you can train him on how to do better.
Yeah.
And that's all we're doing. We expect that. This is what the church sends these kids off to college, where you have very, very smart people who have an agenda, and they seek to dissuade you from your Christian belief system. And if you've never heard the objections before, you're going to take a sucker punch. So it's better to train them and get them used to that kind of discourse rather than to hide it from
them. Yeah,
because let's face it, we're losing our kids now.
Yeah, it's going to be 15 years worth of Sunday school, which is largely going to be pizza parties and movie nights, versus 25 years of atheism. Who's going to win this debate?
Right. Exactly that.
Yeah. And one other aspect of this also is that nowadays, kids don't even have to go to college anymore to hear this. They can be sitting in their rooms on YouTube and say, listening to a song by their favorite Christian band, and then on the side, oh, what's this video here? 10 reasons why the Bible is not the Word of God. That's all it takes.
Yeah, and sometimes they won't even mention that they've run into these things. The Zeitgeist movie is a terrible excuse for an argument against the reality of Jesus and the resurrection. I mean, it can be taken apart simply by reading the source document. You want to read about Horace? Just look up the source documents on the internet. You'll find Horace has absolutely nothing to do with Jesus or Dionysus or Osiris, any of these guys. But kids will watch it and they will go, and they'll go for it. Matter of fact, I have an example. There was a couple of Jehovah's Witnesses who came to my door the other day. This was last year. Matter of fact, it was Halloween last year. And I asked one of the guys, I said, I got to ask you, why did you choose the Watchtower Bible and Tract Society? He goes, well, I was a young Pentecostal man, and I had a couple of witnesses come up to my door, and they started talking about Christmas, and they said, did you know that Christmas wasn't December 25th? And he goes, what do you mean? Well, yeah, the sheep were out in the field, so it couldn't be December 25th. Now, that's a questionable argument. We can't tell one way or the other from that. But here's what happened. He called his pastor after they left. He said, hey, pastor, I had a couple of these guys come to my door, and they brought up this issue about Christmas not being on December 25th, and they talked about the Trinity not being in the Bible and this and that. And the pastor said, are those guys Jehovah's Witnesses? He goes, yeah. He goes, well, don't worry. Just don't listen to them. You don't need to listen to them. Anything they say is wrong. And that's all the pastor gave him. This guy said, witnesses were right. My pastor is trying to hide something from me. And he became a Jehovah's Witness as a result. So hiding the tough questions from our kids may actually push them toward the position that you're trying to protect them from.
Mm-hmm.
And that's dangerous.
Yeah. I will say that quick that a couple weeks or so ago, I did interview Joe Marva here on the topic of pagan copycats, and if anyone's interested in that, it's a great show you need to listen to. And my old ministry partner, J.P. Holding, has written a book, Christmas is Pagan and Other Myths. If anyone's interested in that, you can find that on Amazon. It's a Kindle book. But right now, I need to let people know that what we're listening to right now, it comes from CYI Worldwide. That's who I work with right now. And they do Bibles, prayer, any number of services for people. And you can go to CYIWorldwide.com and find out how to donate to them. But if you want to donate to us specifically at Deeper Waters, you can go to my blog at deeperwaters.wordpress.com and click on the donate button. Now, that will take you to Risen Jesus. That's the ministry of Mike and Debbie Lacona. And you make a donation there, and then it's very important, you email me or you email them and say, hey, I made a donation. I want to go to Nick Peters and Deeper Waters. Your donation would be tax deductible, and I will get it. And people, we need your donations, okay? To keep things going here, it's extremely important that you be supportive. So if you like the podcast, if you like the blogs, if you like everything, be a partner with us and stand with us. Now, some other ways you can donate, we do have some ebooks. I've got, for instance, Defining Inerrancy, the latest one written with J.P. Holding of Tectonics. A portion of that does go to Deeper Waters, and from a blog you'll find an Amazon store that we've got. And if you buy some of the material that's in the Amazon store, we will get a portion of that as well. Now, Lenny, you've got your own ministry, too. Could you tell us about it and how people can support it?
Certainly. Thank you so much. Yes, Come Reason Ministries is a 501c3 organization that helps support not only the writing and speaking that I do, but also training kids to go on these apologetic mission trips. We will take, if you have a church or a youth group that you'd be interested in doing one of these things, give me a call or write me online, and you can. I'll absolutely come out and help you set these kinds of things up. And you can get in touch with us at comereason.org, and we will. We would love to get your support, both prayerfully and financially. We rely on financial donations in order to survive. So yes, they are very important. There's also on that site hundreds of articles on myriads of topics, maybe thousands. You can check that out as well, but that's comereason.org is the best way to get there. Or facebook.com, comereason, comereason on Twitter. And any way you can imagine, you can probably get to me online.
Okay. Well, when you were talking about this pastor, I can't help but think that maybe a couple months or two ago, I went to a funeral for someone, and I was hearing this pastor give this message. And I'm sitting there having to contain myself because I'm getting more and more upset as we go by because the theology is totally wrong. He's talking about the Christian hope that Paul talked about. He's going to 1 Thessalonians 4. And I'm like, yes, yes, go, please don't screw us up. And he says, the hope that we'll see our loved ones again in heaven. And I'm just, I was like, the hope is the resurrection. How can you do this without mentioning the resurrection? And I said, I've reached a point now where I'm wanting to go up to pastors and say, can you give me a reason why I should believe Jesus rose from the dead? And if they give me anything other than something along the lines of, well, I just feel the presence of Jesus in my heart, or if they just say, where the Bible says he rose from the dead, so he did. And my response at this point would be, please get out of the pulpit and give your office to someone who deserves it.
Wow, yeah. Yeah, it was interesting. I was in Starbucks a couple of years ago, and there was a lady there reading The Shack, and that caught my attention. And I'm one to ask people, you know, what they're thinking. So I asked her about the book and if she enjoyed it. She goes, yeah, I really like it. It really reinforces some of the things that my pastor had said about relationship and things like that. And I said, well, what church do you go to? And she mentioned a church that was a Seventh-day Adventist church, but she was talking about how they had a contemporary service and she really believes in this thing and how her pastor really stressed the idea of it's not a religion, it's a relationship. And I said, well, can I ask you a question? Good, Lisa. Why do you need a relationship with Jesus? She goes, what? What? I said, well, you said that you appreciate the relationship. Why do you need a relationship at all with Jesus? What's the point of that relationship? And she struggled and hemmed and hawed a little bit. She said, well, maybe the pastor could say, but it makes me feel. There was no talk about atonement. There was no talk about sin. So when we lapse into this bumper sticker Christianity, as mm-hmm. I call it, we are missing the central aspect of what it means to be Christian. If you throw out the atonement, then what's the point of any of it? Mm-hmm. You know, if we are not raised from a perishable, sinful state to an imperishable, glorious state, where sin and death will no longer afflict us, then yeah, what is the point of it? And again, what worries me about youth ministry is this is where it happens the most,
mm-hmm.
where we tell everybody that we are putting the cookies on the lowest shelf, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
That's a pretty famous phrasing. Well, you know what? Why should we put the cookies on the lowest shelf? Maybe we should strive to reach a little bit higher.
Mm-hmm.
If you keep the cookies on the lowest shelf, everybody gets fat and lazy.
Mm-hmm.
Talk to any trainer. And that's one of the things that worries me about this whole piece. But if you really want to be convicted, you really want to be convicted about this, turn yourself to Hebrews chapter 6, because that's amazing. And at the very last verse of Hebrews chapter 5, Paul, the writer of the book of Hebrews, warns that, you know, you become dull of hearing, you need milk, not solid food, but you should be on solid food. Then you flip the page, Hebrews chapter 6, what is that milk? What are those easy things? So he said, laying aside the elementary doctrines of Christ, the elementary doctrines he talks about, washing, laying on of hands, the resurrection of the dead, eternal judgment. Okay. Those, he says, those are the baby food for Christianity. You should all be able to get that. Let's go on to the higher things.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, he gets Hebrews 6, which is one of the more difficult passages in the entire scripture to deal with. But if the resurrection of the dead, eternal judgment, repentance from dead works and faith towards God, if those are the ABCs, if you will, of Christianity, mm-hmm. then by the time we hit high school, we should have those masters.
Mm-hmm. I'm thinking about a story I saw recently, a friend put up on Facebook, how he said they had Alvin Plantinga come and talk to their church. And, you know, Alvin Plantinga, this is a rare opportunity. One of the greatest Christian philosophers of our time. And he came and he spoke to this church about an evolutionary argument against naturalism. And in the end, what kind of questions were coming up? Are you saying the earth isn't 6,000 to 10,000 years old? Are you saying the Bible is questionable? And when I was saying this, it was just a major facepalm on my part.
And we need to get past those kinds of concepts. Here's another question. If we lament the fact that the university has professors that are preaching secularism,
mm-hmm.
and we concern ourselves that when we send our children to the universities, they're going to be, you know, indoctrinated or swayed. It's natural for people to believe that their own worldview is the right one, and of course they're going to share that.
Yeah.
So what are the churches doing to reach out to the intellectuals?
Mm-hmm.
You know, again, this idea of putting the cookies on the lowest shelf, how does that stick with a gentleman or a lady who has studied years and has a PhD and works at an academic level that's much higher than, I'm not saying that every sermon needs to be a theological treatise.
No.
But maybe once a month you can do something where it stretches people a little bit.
Yeah.
Make them a little uncomfortable, that they have to work intellectually just a touch in order to get up to it, so that the intellectual who's sitting in their midst doesn't feel he's ignored or left out, doesn't walk out of the church saying, there's nothing here for me, this is really a bunch of simpletons, and I'm going to go back to my university setting and you know, stay within my secular framework.
Yeah.
So, that's the question.
Yeah. Here in Knoxville, we live. My wife and I attend an excellent church. It's called The Point. And we actually meet in a movie theater. And she knows that most of the time when we've gone to churches together and such, it's pretty much been When my eyes are glazing over after a while and I'm getting bored and saying, when's the time coming? Because it's all, yeah, I love Christianity, but I've heard all this stuff before over and over, and it's just so simple. I'm not being engaged any. But at this church, I have been thoroughly engaged many times. And we even had a sermon one time, I remember, on the Canaanite conquest. And I actually texted one of my friends and said, oh my gosh, I can't believe I'm actually hearing a sermon on the Canaanite conquest. Most churches just ignore that. And even for us, we've got something at the end of every service that, during the service, if you've had any sort of question whatsoever, you text it in, and the pastor comes out at the end and addresses your question. And I'm listening, look at this, and I'm thinking, why isn't this being done more often elsewhere?
Right, or even Sunday school classes that can, you know, at least offer something to individuals who want to go deeper. And you know, apologetics classes are wonderful for dealing with difficult issues and raising the level of discourse. And we have to do something, I mean, because there are far too few Christians who are able to make cogent arguments for their faith.
Right.
One of the things that has just alarmed me is just today I saw a post saying that InterVarsity Christian Club has been around for 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
And all California state universities, 23 of the California state universities in the California Public University System, have derecognized InterVarsity's Christian clubs on college campuses simply because of the Cal State rules of, quote, tolerance,
mm-hmm.
quote, where be required to allow an atheist to be president of your InterVarsity fellowship. So InterVarsity said, no, that we can't do that. That doesn't make any sense. You know, you don't allow Ted Nugent to be head of PETA, and you don't allow a Klansman to be head of the NAACP, and you don't allow an atheist to be head of InterVarsity.
Mm-hmm.
You just don't do that kind of thing. But they said that it's being intolerant and bigoted. And so they have thus de-recognized. Now all these kids who are part of the InterVarsity Fellowship at the college campus are not going to get the same opportunities to show the club, to attract new students, or to take advantage of school resources as, say, the Atheist Club or somebody else, because they just simply won't do that. And this is the club we're in. Our culture is in really a spiritual freefall right now, seeing these things changing so rapidly. And that's why the church needs to kind of pick these up and make sure that they're stretching the intellectual capacity of our young people so that when college happens, they can respond appropriately.
Mm-hmm.
We've had really good response. One of the other things that we've done is we've done college forums, where they set up a table with three or four of us sitting at a table, a Christian pastor and a youth minister and myself. And then we have a microphone out in the courtyard, and we ask any student who wants to, you know, come up and ask about Christianity, ask about Christian worldview, ask a question about the Bible. And we have these 2 to 3 hour conversations with students that we engage in the public square, literally, in the courtyard of the college. And hundreds of kids are listening to these things, and they come off surprised, saying, wow, you guys were really respectful, and you were, you know, intelligent. I didn't expect Christianity or Christians to behave this way. I thought you guys would all be fundamentalists. So one of the ways we make an impact is by going in the middle of college and making a splash by doing that.
One way we should explain that you do this, before we forget and run out of time, is that you've actually had a debate with Richard Carrier. Well, for the audience who might not know, who is Richard Carrier?
Well, Richard Carrier is probably one of the more well-known internet atheists. He started a website called InternetInfidels.org. He since has received a degree in ancient history from Columbia University in New York, and he's written several books, Sense and Goodness Without God, as well as others. Fairly big name in internet atheist circles. Maybe not top tier like Richard Dawkins, Sam Harris, but definitely secondary.
Mm-hmm.
So what happened was we had challenged Dawkins, we had challenged Richard Carrier to a debate. A guy at UCR, at the Christian Club at UCR, put this on. Unfortunately, it only gave me 6 weeks to prepare. It was quite a roller coaster, but we debated on the existence of God. Does God exist, was the question. And we had a packed house of about 700 students who came in, line wrapped all the way around the building. People were waiting to get in. And it was a very interesting exchange. That exchange is actually even up on YouTube. You can go take a look at it. But the more interesting piece was what I heard after the debate. Now, you can say who won, who lost. The atheists are going to say the atheist guy won. Christians are going to say the Christian guy won. But on Sunday, I had a family come up to me, father, mother, and young man who were their sons. And they came up, and the father said, you know, my son went to your debate. Oh, great. How did you like it? The kid said, well, I went to the debate because I was really kind of leaving the faith, and I wanted to go there to get ammunition from the atheists in order to use against my Christian friends. But after the debate, and after hearing the arguments, I decided I needed to come back to church.
Excellent.
So there's an example of just how exposing people to the arguments for the existence of God can make a huge difference.
Yeah, I really think, in fact, it'd be great for churches to host more debates, like Willow Creek did with Frank Zindler versus William Lane Craig, because, I mean, a sermon, a lot of people aren't going to go out to hear a sermon, but you put a debate out there, I mean, to people that sounds like confrontation, it sounds like, oh, there's a fight going on, it's going to be a knockdown battle, hey, let's go see that one.
Yeah, exactly. And the other piece is, if you invite someone to a church service, usually at a an evangelistic crusade, 90% of the audience, 80-90% is going to be Christian. At a debate, there's at least 50-50.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes the atheists outnumber the Christians in a college setting. So you have an opportunity to reach a much many more non-believers in a debate setting and have them really think about the issue.
Lee Strobel has talked about that Willow Creek debate and said traffic was lined up for miles on the other. People were rushing into the church. When was the last time you saw people running into a church? And the thing was being broadcast to other churches. Some of them even had commentators discussing the debate.
Yeah, and that's the way we can do it. When we go on campus with our students, for example, we don't take an in-your-face tap. People ask me, you know, how do you do this? How do you, you know, sending these 15-year-old kids to the Berkeley atheist, how do you do that? So, well, we don't come up to them and say, can I tell you about Jesus? That won't get you very far.
Right.
What we do is we created surveys, and we send them in groups of two, and we come up to students, and we ask them, hey, would you mind if I ask you a couple of questions? I have a survey here on moral and religious values, or religious truth. And most of the time, they'll say, yeah. Now, they're giving you permission to talk to them, so you're not confronting them. And you're standing kind of shoulder to shoulder as opposed to face to face, which they're going to be more open, they're going to be more honest. And the surveys are constructed in such a way as to lead them into seeing the conflicting worldview that they hold. For example, it'll say, you know, is there such a thing as absolute moral value? And most people on Berkeley will say, absolutely not. There's no absolute moral values. Morality is merely reflective of whatever the society says. Okay. And so we go down, but a few more questions. It says, what do you think is the one problem plaguing all of humanity? And everybody at Berkeley has an answer to that question. They all have a problem. I don't know, global warming or the subjugation of women or the minimum wage, whatever the case may be. So then our students are trained to say, well, if this is a problem that affects all of humanity, how can you say that there's no absolute morality? Because you seem to be implying that it's a problem for everyone. And now you're into a conversation. And we've had, after 40 or 50 minutes, we've had atheists thank us for stopping and talking about this issue. Now, when was the last time you saw an atheist thank a Christian for asking them about things about religion and morality?
Yeah.
It's a wonderful conversational tool, and it's not confrontational. these are some of the ways that we train kids to do this. We train them to ask more questions, make fewer statements, to try to understand that worldviews have consequences, and mm-hmm. if a worldview is incoherent, if it's self-contradictory or something like that, then that worldview should be rejected. And what they do by experience is they find out that, yeah, these views don't hold water.
Something that we should also stress is that the email that I started this section with, I heard back from someone. One thing when I emailed him back, I said that, you know, I'll be glad to dialogue with your son and talk about the issues, but you're going to need to be doing your own part. And I think parents too often neglect this, and they think it's going to be the church's responsibility to bring them up. Many times they forget. I mean, they can do a great job bringing them up morally, teaching them what the Bible says, but they can often lose sight of the intellectual batters. And that it's great, and I think it's great that there are people like you or I or others out there that they can email and ask questions, but it's best that before the kids go off or they're going to deconvert, you prepare them for what's coming, because it's usually much, much harder to reach them after they've kind of, they might have had some, like, sort of a chip on their shoulder at that point.
Yes, exactly. And again, like the illustration I used earlier, if they think they've been lied to, if they think you're keeping something from them, that's the quickest way to build that barrier.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to be open and honest with our kids today. It's just kind of the way we do it. And you're absolutely right that we can't merely say, it's the church's responsibility, I'm going to pot it off on them, just like we wouldn't do that with their education. You know, you check to make sure your kids are doing their homework.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You answer the questions that they have in mathematics, because you don't want them to have a wrong understanding of mathematics. Well, isn't this a more important educational point than even mathematics?
Yeah, or I'm thinking also that when I was dating my wife, her parents knew a little bit about me beforehand, and so they knew I was a good guy. I mean, I'm sure they were still keeping an eye on me, checking on me, such. But if you have a daughter and some guy comes knocking on your door and say, hey, I'd like to take your daughter out, you're not just going to say, oh, sure, go ahead, just have her back such time. No, you're going to want to talk to this guy. You're going to get his phone number. You're going to find out all you can about him. And probably before you even let him go out on the first date, you're going to be calling other parents, calling relatives, checking school records, and doing whatever you can, saying, okay, is this the kind of guy I want my daughter to go out with? And also, if you have a daughter and she's working in a part-time that might not be safe, you're going to equip her with mace or maybe teach her how to use a gun or self-defense. You're not going to send a child of yours out into a dangerous spot unprepared. So why would you do that with college campuses?
Right, exactly. And so we need to, again, take this a little bit more seriously, I think, and make sure that we are doing justice to our students, to our youth, in preparing them. And you know what? They thrive on it.
Mm-hmm.
I talk with them because they get so excited about finding out that there are deep things, that there are deeper waters, if you will, that they can swim in.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't want to be in the baby school anymore. They want to actually go out and stretch their arms, stretch their legs a little bit. If you can do that in a controlled environment, like one of these apologetic mission trips, it's all the better. So I think it's a great opportunity. I wish more churches would contact me in order to set up these kinds of things. We could do it anywhere in the country.
Yeah, I especially appreciate how you talk about going into the deeper waters. That's exactly why I chose the name I chose for my ministry, because I've said, too often the church is staying on the shallow end. We need to go deep. And I think it's really important that you stress out, because we talk about how we are entertaining our youth too much. I wrote about this in a blog post, entertaining our youth to apostasy. And when we say this, we're not opposed to fun and entertainment anyway, because in the long run, I think apologetics is excellent fun. That's not why we do it. But it is incredibly enjoyable. I mean, my wife can tell you, when the debate starts and those questions start coming in, my eyes light up. I am ready to go.
Yeah, well, another aspect of apologetics that people don't realize is it's self beneficial.
Right.
It's self-ministerial. And by that, I mean, I'll give you an example. When my wife was pregnant with our third child, she was ready to deliver, but she went into a very serious condition called health sickness, which affects only, a minute, less than 1% of the pregnancies. It's a life-threatening condition. And she had, she was basically ready to die before she could deliver. It was pretty dangerous. And I was praying. I was saying, you know, God, help her. I don't know why this is happening. I don't know why we're facing this. And, you know, it's at those low points in your life, it's at those difficult times where you start asking, you know, does God even hear my prayer? It's not getting any better. Is it maybe God doesn't really even exist at all? This is the natural recourse that a lot of people have when they're dealing with severe difficulties. But with me, I can say, I can't doubt that God exists. I've already worked through that. I can't doubt that Jesus rose from the dead. I've already worked through that. I did that at a time when I wasn't emotionally disturbed. It's a terrible, worst time in the world to ask these questions.
Yeah.
When you're emotionally shaken.
Mm-hmm.
But because of apologetics, I did that at a point in time where I was calm. So I said, I know God is there. I don't understand it, but I can at least trust in him. Now, that wouldn't be possible without my apologetics.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't merely faith. It was my faith was maybe shaken by circumstances. But it was the facts that I had that allowed me to continue and cling to my faith. And Christianity has always been a belief system based on evidence.
Mm-hmm.
And Paul makes that very clear in 1 Corinthians 15. As you alluded, if we are not raised from the dead, then we are still in our sins. You know, we are of all people to be most pitied. Christianity has always been a faith that is based on historical evidence. And if you don't know that, if you haven't studied that, then you're susceptible yourself to fall away or to doubt or to have problems like this. So apologetics, I agree with you. I have a lot of fun doing it.
Yeah.
And we have a lot of interesting conversations with people. It's always very stimulating. But it's also self-ministerial in that it builds you up for those difficult times that can come.
Yeah, one aspect of that from my own personal life is when I found out about apologetics, I was actually in a dark spot in my life because I've been going through depression and panic attacks at that point. And with everything, I was wanting to know about God, especially saying, okay, are you there? And am I really yours? And when I found out about apologetics, and I just started reading, and it was like one day I'd wake up and say, oh, I'm not really depressed anymore. I don't really have panic attacks anymore. I mean, yeah, there are still times I'll have bits of depression and such. That's kind of unavoidable. But for the most part, no. And the questions that used to bother me and keep me up at night, I'm no longer blinking at them. And I think one of the greatest things I found is, you know what, you can be someone who's intellectually bent, you can be smart. I mean, when I was in high school, I was elected senior superlative, most studious, so I'm not just saying this about myself or trying to boost myself up. That's something that all my peers would have told you. But you can be intelligent, and you can be a Christian at the same time. You can actually serve God with your mind.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, and we forget about that. You know, Jesus says, love your God with all of your heart, soul, mind.
Mm-hmm.
We want to go out to the mission field in Ecuador or Mexico and build facilities, and that's important.
Mm-hmm.
Take wells in Africa, and that's important. And love God who has retreats. And times of reflection, and that's all important. But we also need to love God through our study. And, that's one of those pieces that Jesus emphasized, and I think that's important for us.
Yeah, and it does affect how we live morally as well. When I was dating Allie, of course I was tempted a lot of times sexually, but I also had within me a whole theological background of why certain behaviors are right and why certain behaviors are wrong. And today, when we're husband and wife, I have a greater theological background of, okay, here's what the Bible says about marriage, here's what reason says about marriage, here's what Paul and Jesus say about how a husband is to treat his wife, here's what the gospel says about forgiveness, both giving and receiving, and I've had to receive quite my share of it here. But all of those have been informative and I found out about all of those because I was studying apologetics, because the more I studied apologetics, you learn about God more, and the more you learn about God, the more you learn, hey, here's how I'm supposed to be living my life. In fact, if you do it right, it makes you a more moral person.
Yeah, exactly. Matter of fact, here's an interesting thing, and I think a lot about this, because I don't think that we communicate sexual purity well in the church. We say that they don't. We don't. That's not enough, I don't think, for a picture. I've been kind of thinking through this, and I think of two things. First of all, have you ever seen the movie Christmas Story? We watch this every year at Christmas.
Yeah.
There's a scene in that movie where one kid is dared to stick his tongue on the flagpole.
Yep.
And he joins his tongue to the flagpole, and naturally it's a cold winter day, and the flagpole's frozen, and his tongue freezes straight to the flagpole. And it's a humorous piece where the fire truck has to come in, and the firemen have to free him. And, you know, a little bit of that tongue was left on that flagpole. He got separated from it, and he went on to live his life, but just a little bit of that tongue that was left on his on that flagpole. And that's what happens when people get together. Also, when you join together with a prostitute, you are one with her in some sense. So even if you separate, there's a little bit of yourself left there. And we need to make these pictures. God has given us sexual relationships. Sexual relationship is actually not a dirty thing.
Nope.
It's a holy thing.
Mm-hmm.
But nobody talks about it as holy. I mean, you don't take a cross and, you know, throw it in the gutter. Or a priest's garment and throw it in the gutter. You don't take what's holy and run it through that which would debase it, because you have respect for the thing itself. And if we had a message more to our kids that says sex is something holy and you just don't want to debase it with pornography, with one-night stands, with hookups, things like that, all you're doing is you're taking what is the best of you and you're running it through the gutter. You know, maybe that's a different way, a better way to communicate these kinds of ideas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm thinking about when I heard a sermon like this once. I mean, I was still a college guy at the time, and the preacher was giving a silver ring thing service, and he was using the don'ts, and I swear, I was getting bored hearing it. And I'm thinking, if you can take this topic and make it boring, you are doing something wrong.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, that shouldn't be the topic where we lose the interest of our young people.
Yeah.
But it shouldn't also be a simply, like I said, it's very elementary school that they just don't.
Yeah.
There needs to be more. We don't even do that with drugs. We say it's going to affect your mind, it's going to affect your growth. We give, you know, outcomes, and we talk about, you know, how mind-altering substances can change and can have permanent consequences. Like that.
Well, we're getting to the point where, unfortunately, we do have to start wrapping things up. It's only a two-hour show, and yes, the time does seem to fly. Lenny, if someone has liked what they've heard from you and they'd like to find out more about you, do you have a place where they can go, where they can get in touch with you?
Well, absolutely. Again, comereason.org is kind of the central hub of all that we do. We have a YouTube channel. We have a weekly podcast where I take my my Sunday school class teachings, basically, and put those online. Twitter, you can get to me from Twitter from there, or Facebook, you can link to me there. But that is the central place, comereason.org. That's the place where you can connect and read all these different articles. Subscribe to the blog, subscribe to the email update, because we offer that on a monthly basis as well. And you can always keep in touch with what we're doing or places I'll be speaking or things like that.
And do you have any final message you'd like to leave with the Deeper Waters audience?
I would just say that if you have a question or if you'd like to hear more about any of these ideas, please get in touch with us. You can email me at lenny@comereason.org. Again, if you want to help support our efforts as we reach out to others, sometimes when we go on these trips, not all the kids have the money to go, so we'll help raise money for them, or it'll help pay for my time. So these trips are like 5 or 6 days sometimes where we'll go to Utah. Matter of fact, it was interesting. Last year, or just this year, we went to Manti, Utah. And when you look at, say, the 1040 window, those people in the 1040 window are considered some of the least reached people groups on the face of the earth. Anybody who has less than 2% Christian population, they consider as an unreached people group. The Joshua Project has kind of come up with this stat. Mm-hmm. And I was in Manti, Utah, and in the county, there was less than 1% Christian in the entire county. I mean, these people were Mormons through and through, and they were an unreached people group. So by going in there with our kids, you know, several of them made friends. I have girls who are continuously corresponding, even after 3 or 4 weeks after the trip, still talking to these people, which is interesting. I have one girl who went on a Muslim trip last year, and she is now becoming a missionary to Libya. Mm-hmm. And so just amazing things that can happen for these people. So if you want to help support those things, go to cumreason.org and provide a donation there.
Well, yeah, I'd like to thank you for taking your time, and especially on short notice, really only a couple of days or so ago, to be my guest on the Deeper Waters podcast, and I hope we'll see you again sometime.
Yeah, I'd like to, Nick. Thanks for having me. I appreciate all you do.
Thank you. And I can remind everyone that next week, Trevor Ray Sloan is going to be on, talking about his book on winsome apologetics. For now, I am Nick Peters of the Deeper Waters podcast, and I will see you next week.
It's here, the official Grok Radio mobile app. Listen to your favorite Grok Radio programs on your iPhone, iPad, iPod, Kindle Fire, Android smartphones, and tablets. The best thing is, it's absolutely free. Download it now from the iTunes or Google Play App Store, or get a link at our website, cyiworldwide.com. Grok Radio, Christian radio that doesn't suck.
You're listening to Grok Radio. 2.0